Thanks, Andrew. So the title is, as in the program, Intervention in Space and Affirmation of Self, the Ethics of Improvement. This is the beginning of a project which is basically a return to something I've done some time ago about the fashioning of space, in particular the ideology of improvement. And I will, in the project, look at economic theory in its interrelation with morality and aesthetic, the aesthetic aspect of that. What I'll do here is perhaps I thought I'll stake out a few of the contexts that are relevant for this this idea of human intervention in space, and then I'll do a little bit of a microhistory with a two brief case studies that illustrate particular moments, interesting moments in that, right? So here are a few of the contexts. One is the notion of climate change in a positive rather than in a negative sense. The idea that we could interfere with the landscape and change the climate for the better, and therefore disprove, or rather not disprove, but simply live with Montesquieu's climatic determinism. Determinism, right? I think those of you who've read Catherine's letters to Voltaire know that she was harboring great hopes that by draining the marshlands around St. Petersburg and planting trees and things like that, you can turn the city into a livable one, and that this would then in turn soften mores and so on and so forth, right? So that's one of the relevant contexts. Another context which kind of militates against that is the theodicy, the justification of God's creation, which really implies an acceptance of things as they are, including natural catastrophes and so on and so forth, and possibly may instill a certain passiveness in terms of seeking to enhance agricultural yields and so on and so forth. Contrary to England, where a utilitarian mindset had already been established quite early in the modern age, in Russia that is a work in progress. Really, there is a need on the part of landowners, for example, to try to instill a sort of a utilitarian mindset in their serfs, and that really doesn't work very well, to judge from all the evidence, particularly the literary evidence we have about this. So there's a possible tension between the pursuit of economic rationality and the submission to a god perceived to be a god who intervenes directly in nature. Furthermore, there was a kind of an additional dimension to this, which is because of the availability of land in Russia, there was really no economic incentive to enhance productivity, because it was perceived to be easier simply to create more tillable land rather than to improve the yield, the fertility of land. So there is this kind of traditional mindset, which is let's just open a new field rather than worry about how can we make this field more fertile. And Andrei Bolotov, for example, admitted that most landowners, and I quote him, do not care at all about the rural economy or about its improvement, nor are they bothered by the decay of agriculture. And there was already in the 18th century, there's a talk about the decay of agriculture in the sense of the productivity of land declining. So he makes the case, Bolotov, that land may not correct itself and change its own nature. It demands the assistance of human hands, which the wise creator has anointed to work. Right. So the way to combine the theodicy and the utilitarian argument is to say that we human beings have been created to work, right? And working means working the land and improving yields that way. So that's the second context. The third one is a landscape as a response to alienation from court life or from patronage relations. Living on an estate could provide the necessary distance from court life to escape from its constricting aspects, although it also meant removal from its rewards, such as network of connections, advancement, and so on and so forth. Fashioning landscape means the creation of an environment that is less private than the home and remains representational in the sense that it represents the status and distinction of the landowner. But at the same time, there is the rise of this pastoral idea, which Andrew has written about, the pastoral and Stoic ideal of retreat to the countryside based on the model of the ancients, and there are people who argue that this is just as honorable as making your serving on the battlefield and so on and so forth. So in certain cases, life on the estate embodied liberal values such as autonomy of the self, the notion of a philosophical self-cultivation, self-improvement, honor as a warrant of moral autonomy, and things like that. So that's a third possible context. The extent to which that's actually a reality is under debate. Dimension of the problem is landscaping as a display of taste, and increasingly towards the end of the 18th century also a display of intimate memories and personal values. So there's a progressive individualization and subjectivization of the landscape as a mirror of the self and as a memorial place, and we could mention many examples without passing on quickly here. So space is endowed with installations that evoke memories and feelings. The garden becomes a locus of meditation, recollection, of a cultivation of a certain interiority. So it's part of a sort of absorption with the self, which has also a dimension of self-improvement. And that opens up an interesting gap and contradiction or tension, if you wish, between the landowner as an administrative extension of autocratic power in the countryside, and on the other side, this self-image as an autonomous agent of social, moral, and aesthetic improvement. The fifth context is, going slightly in a different digression, aestheticization or aesthetics as a space of fashion, right? So it's not necessarily the case that if you build your English garden, it means that you want to project your own memories or your own taste into it. It's also because it simply is a fashion at the time and everybody is doing it. So it becomes a theater of distinction, to use John Randolph's useful phrase. But the problem is that, of course, it involves quite a bit of cost. And so creating a lavish garden, it means participating in an economy of consumption and excess that was in itself debated and quite controversial. So to go back to Bolotov, for example, who has a very strong commitment to rational efficiency. On the other hand, he also wants to aestheticize his landscape, and the way he resolves that tension is by saying you can do it cheaply. You can build an English garden on the cheap, and it works very well. So he continuously in his memoirs and in his works, he shows how it's really not that time consuming. And of course, he assumes that labor is not really a commodity that needs to be quantified because we have serfs doing the work for us. Now, this sort of aestheticization is also westernizing a project that grows out of a genuine need for improvement, for improving and appropriating the landscape. Thanks, Andrew. The idea here is that we really need to identify with Russia. We need to make it look more like England or Switzerland or Germany or what have you. And this so that it becomes more suitable to patriotic identification. And the final context I just want to evoke here is, of course, the relations to serfs and discussions about what methods of serf management are suitable. And there is a whole range here from appointing a steward to working by example, which is residing on the estate and shaming the serfs into working by working yourself quite hard, so that they feel that if you in your high position. The landowner works, then of course they must work as well. There is attempts to rule by regulation, in other words, writing rather complex nakaze, sets of rules, which sort of reflect a kind of a contractual thinking, legalistic thinking, which of course the Russian peasant doesn't really have much need of. But this is one of the ways landowners, in particular through the free economic society, have been trying to manage their estates. And then there's, of course, the threat of tyrannical authority, punishment by by the steward and so on and so forth. Each of these methods also implies a certain self-image. And the larger point here is that civilizing the serfs also requires a process of self-civilization, self-improvement, so that the binary opposition between colonizer and colonized really doesn't quite work in this context, because there is work to be done on both sides of that interface. So that's by way of introduction. So let's look at two case studies. I'll use a Randolph's notion of the theater of distinction as a kind of a launch pad. It's an interesting, quite flexible concept. Randolph doesn't quite define it. It's not quite clear whether he means distinction simply as a form of eminence or superiority, or whether he means distinction from the court, for example, or distinction from the serfs, and so on and so forth. And what I would like to try to capture here is the moment when the theater of distinction laps into a theater of interiority or a theater of alienation, and the two often go together. So the first case study is Savinsky, the estate of the well-known Freemason Ivan Lapukhin. A couple of words about his career, which was quite turbulent, as his Masonic ties and intense publishing activities made him suspect in Catherine's eyes when she became concerned about the Freemasons. He was forced to retire from service in 1785 when he refused to forswear his Masonic affiliations and insisted that being a Mason made him a better public servant. He was closely associated with Novikov and escaped exile only because he had a father who lived in Moscow and he was blind, and so he was assigned to residence in Moscow to take care of his father. He then, once Paul came to power, attempted to serve at court again, but because of his moral intransigence again, that attempt was short-lived. And at that point, he retired to his estate and started to fashion it the way he wanted. And he hoped to be able to retire peacefully on it when Alexander called him back to service, and he reluctantly accepted to do so for a few more years. But nevertheless, he had enough time to actually fashion his estate the way he wanted. And the estate here is quite clearly a testimonial to his philosophical interests, and it materializes his intellectual and spiritual journey. Reflecting his quietist convictions, the gardens feature tributes to Fenelon, Madame de Guyon, Jacob Böhme, Karl von Eckartshausen, Quirinus Kuhlmann, in addition to Ernst Jung, the genius Socrates, Lomonosov, and his protector Nikolai Repnin. What is intriguing, it seems to me, is the fact that it also features a place called Rousseau's Shack, which included two inscriptions on the theme of freedom from society and on self-reliance. So the first one is, in translation, "The wildest solitude seems to be preferable to the society of the wicked. La plus sauvage solitude me paraît préférable à la société des méchants," which is from Promenade du rêveur solitaire. And then the other one is, "Celui-là vraiment est libre qui n'a pas besoin de mettre le bras d'un autre au bout des siens pour faire sa volonté." Somewhat both rise from Emile, right? So only he is really free who does not need to put someone else's arm at the end of his own to get his way. So what is intriguing here is that Lapukhin had been infatuated with Rousseau in his youth, but had since then sharply turned against him and wrote several treatises against Rousseau. As he registers in his memoirs, which were written in 1808-1809, he had enjoyed reading Voltaire's mockery and Rousseau's rebuttals and other such works, but at some point, as he was translating D'Holbach's Système de la Nature, he experienced a kind of an epiphany and realized the sinfulness of it all, burned the manuscript of his translation, and then proceeded to write a series of treatises against Enlightenment reason. One of them is called On the Abuse of Reason by Several Modern Writers, and then there are two essays against Rousseau, one in 1784, and one in 1805, so spanning the time when he develops his estate and celebrates Rousseau. And then also much of what he writes about the French Revolution, you know, blames, you know, he kind of buys this argument that it's the philosophers who are responsible for it, in particular reason and the cult of reason and so on and so forth. And yet none of this prevented him from, you know, creating this shack of Rousseau in the garden, which is modeled after Rousseau's, the monument to Rousseau in Ermenonville, which was erected after his death. Right, so we have a kind of a bifurcated response to the Genevan philosopher, and that suggests that he's cited here not so much for his philosophical ideas or ideological considerations or anything like that, but more as an kind of a symbol of a stance of moral independence from society. Right, so the garden operates a distinction between a quest for moral freedom, in particular the freedom from the constraints of patronage relations, and the ideological ramifications of a commitment to freedom. It's, of course, a little bit paradoxical to use Rousseau for that, because as we've been reminded of this morning, I think, by Marianne, Rousseau was benefited from protective work throughout his life and got through his life, basically, thanks to different kinds of protection. But nonetheless, here he embodies, commitment to the voice of morality within, and a refusal of society with a capital S. So Rousseau in his shack, living in self-sufficient simplicity, if not poverty, suffering this indignity because of his moral ideas, becomes a mirror of the sacrifice Le Poquin is willing to make for the sake of preserving his honor and dignity. Right? And if one juxtaposes the garden with Le Poquin's memoirs, one sees a man who insists on his inborn aspiration to do good and on his inability to use reason to hold this, you know, passion for good in check. Furthermore, in explaining this natural propensity towards good, La Poquin uses the same metaphor of the arm as the expression of one's will, as in the inscription from Emile. So I quote, "There were circumstances when reason deemed it necessary and sought to restrain my hand, but of course it never ever succeeded. I tell the artless truth." Right? So in other words, reason is seen as practical reason, the ability to pursue what is politically or socially expedient, but for La Poquin, it is powerless to hold passion in check. Much like Rousseau, La Poquin posits an innate disposition towards good, which society and practical reasons may corrupt. And the strictures of patronage relations impose a certain logic of behavior which deflects from the pursuit of good and which La Poquin, like Rousseau, is unwilling and unable to accept. So he notes that, for example, he disliked feasts and festivities, and therefore he never threw any parties. Likewise, he isn't into gambling, so he hasn't. So whenever, the few times he had to gamble, he lost very little money because he gambled very little because he doesn't like it, and so on and so forth, right? So all these sort of stereotypes of social behavior, of sociability, are ones that he rejects. And there is a similar pattern at work in his financial dealings. He was quite heavily indebted at the time, and eventually wrote a contorted petition to Alexander, asking him if he would purchase one of his estates to allow him to settle his debt. And in that letter, he notes that in 1796, at the beginning of Paul's reign, he had an opportunity to ask Paul to forgive all his debts. He didn't want to do that because he didn't want to ask for something without merit. So he didn't want to ask for favor. So on this occasion, instead of doing that, he offers a financial transaction, right? Purchase an estate from me so that I can then settle my debts. As if, that exchange of economic assets would preserve his moral liberty. And throughout his notes, patronage relations are presented as a political sphere whose logic may sometimes interfere with a Christian and Masonic pursuit of truth and good, and which therefore needs to be rejected. So the identification with Rousseau, I posit, rests on this notion of transcending practical reason and following the voice of truth. And in the context of Rousseau's reputation as one of the instigators of the revolution, there is something quite unpolitic in flaunting an attachment to him through an installation in a garden. Yet this is precisely what makes it attractive to La Pouchine, all the more so that it brings to mind his youthful, you know, infatuation with Rousseau, and thus, you know, ties the present and the past together. In short, the theater of distinction, you know, to come back to that expression here, is a complex thing, because distinction arises not from any sort of social eminence, but rather from harnessing honor to the dictates of the heart, quite independently from any social expediency. So distinction, I think, seamlessly moves into accepting social alienation and cultivating interiority. Now, the second case study is Primuchina, the estate of the Bakunin family, and in particular the decisions made by Alexander Bakunin as he took over the running of the estate. We have Randolph's book here, which is very useful as a basis on the creation of home on Bakunin's estate, but I'll take the argument in a slightly different direction. So again, a quick reminder, Bakunin grew up and studied in Italy, served in Turin for the College of Foreign Affairs in the mission to the Kingdom of Sardinia, and at the same time completed a degree, wrote a PhD dissertation in Latin on intestinal worms. So quite an interesting character. His career started out quite brilliantly and quickly made it to the sixth rank when it was cut short because his father was in ill health and his mother asked him and interceded with the authorities to have him freed so that he could return to the estate and manage the family patrimony. So here, the retirement to the estate, unlike in the case of La Pouchine, was inspired by economic necessity. Someone, he was the oldest, the youngest son, and someone had to manage their affairs. All the more that the family was quite indebted at the time. So it's not out of moral principle, but rather economic necessity that he takes over the management of the estate. He turns to his friend and protector Nikolai Lvov and asks him if there is a way the family debts could be forgiven. And he makes the case that he will then, as a manager of the estate, run affairs in such a way that the estate will become self-reliant, that there will be a rational set of policies and reforms so that this makes it worthwhile to forgive the debt of the family. Right? And then he says that he will be henceforth, and I quote, acting rather than working, and in parentheses he adds, people work only against their will. Right, so what he's doing is not working, but acting, and so in saying this, he affirms his social autonomy based on running rationally an estate. Randolph argues that Bakunin, and I quote, began to see himself neither as a servitor nor as an aspiring self-lord, but rather as a provincial family man whose opinions deserved respect because they were rooted in domestic experience. And of quote, that is, in the pursuit of rationality and social utility. So there are various strands to his activities on the estate. One major sphere is the attempts to redefine his relationship with serfs, and he wrote an extensive so-called agreement between landlord and peasant, completed in 1802, which he presented to his serfs, and they rejected it out of hand. But he also, he also sent it through, through friends to officials as a kind of a possible model of, a certain kind of emancipation of the serfs. So he saw there was exemplary value in it. So the main clause of the agreement was to confer an inalienable hereditary patrimony to each peasant household, although they would have to pay a lease for that, which is a third of the yield of the estate. There were provisions limiting the power of the noble landlord, for example, the fact that he could no longer force marriages or recruit serfs for the military. And there were also duties, you know, placed on peasants. For example, the requirement to plant fruit trees, to drain bogs, to keep bees, erect hedges, and plant potatoes. In other words, and I quote, способствовать благообразию земной поверхности, right, to contribute to the improvement of the surface of the, you know, the soil. The idea being that, you know, through these improvements to the landscape, the economic well-being of the serfs would be enhanced, and therefore also their mores. So there's a kind of idea of a kind of contractual obligation to pursue. So he was forcing peasants, right, if they accepted liberty, freedom, to pursue a kind of a form of economic rationality. Now, the other main project is the aesthetic transformation of the environment, and I'll try to show that there are kind of social and moral underpinnings to that. In a letter to Lvov dated 1804, Bakunin delineates his aesthetic ideal, and here he writes in response to a letter from Lvov, where Lvov says, "It's very strange, you've spent a number of years on the estate and you haven't yet developed a nice garden, yet you lived in Italy, you've seen beautiful gardens. I mean, really, what's going on?" And Bakunin answers, "I didn't like cropped gardens even in a happy climate," in other words, French gardens or Italian gardens. "You can imagine then how our gardens must have seemed to me. A wall of black, prickly, and unmoving fir trees, lime trees shaped like hats or mushrooms, willows like milestones, all concurred to deprive strollers of comforting sun rays in our severe climate. Dark, moldy alleys, which are never penetrated by fresh air, seemed like funerary corridors better suited for bats than for people, and horrendous idols under the name of statues seemed like scarecrows, which are hardly needed in these cemeteries of taste and nature." So that's about French gardens in Russia. In the milieus of the protectors of the Russian estate, you rarely see that sort of stuff cited, because it's all about glorifying the estate. Now here's what he says about Russian English gardens. "Alas, I also saw in our fatherland some serpentinesque gardens." That's my translation of Yurchete, which is, I think, a neologism of Bakunin's. A sad spruce and pine tree, willows that bore with their repetition, monotonous greenery, flocks of rooks and ravens, moth instead of a lawn, and sinuous path, puddles and caves under the name of lakes and grottos. I must admit that instead of reconciling me with our climate, these gardens only exacerbated in my mind any thoughts about its severity. In Moscow, I saw mountains, seas, forests, wilderness, and God knows what behind railings on 20 sajens." Right? So he kind of objects, right, to the lack of suitability to the Russian climate, the imitativeness, the use of inappropriate sculpture, and the attempts to saturate gardens with all kinds of exogenous landscapes. Right? Elsewhere, I've argued that in his views on the need to adopt an aesthetics congruent with the surrounding landscape, Bakunin was influenced by the description of Julie's garden in La Nouvelle Héloïse. In his next letter, Bakunin then lays out, so to Lvov, right, he lays out what he would consider to be a Russian garden. And having described the rundown condition of the village, you know, where the serfs lived, he goes on, "A beautiful garden next to such a village would be a fierce reproach to the landlord. I don't want a handsome garden to throw into relief the ugliness of my village, but rather I'd like the village to be an attractive introduction to my garden. And then I will have, I promise you, not a cropped garden, nor a serpentinesque one, neither an English nor a Chinese one, but a Russian garden. The opportunity to design my woods, my fields, and my meadows will make me into a gardener." So the aesthetic impulse, in other words, is funneled not so much in the creation of a circumscribed garden, right, but it must exert itself in all parts of the estate to enhance the entire environment for the benefits of all who live and work there on the estate. Now that idea is actually not quite original. We find a similar idea in René-Louis de Girardin's De la composition des paysages, a translation into Russian of which appeared in 1804, so that very year, where there is a similar rejection of both French and English gardens, and where there is the same emphasis on transforming the whole rural environment. In his foreword, the editor of De Girardin states that this treatise is not about gardens, but that ici on traite principalement des campagnes, de leur embellissement, de leur culture et de leur subsistance. Et si l'on se détermine à réimprimer aujourd'hui ces mêmes feuilles, c'est que le plus beau spectacle de la nature serait sans doute celui de campagnes heureuses. Right, so it's about the moral regeneration of the countryside to turn it into a campagne heureuse. There are also some more specific, formal similarities between De Girardin and Bakunin, which I won't go into now. You know, things about using water in the garden and the way to compose the garden. You know, things like that, more kind of aesthetic, specifically aesthetic things. But the important thing is that in De Girardin finishes his treatise on landscaping with a chapter on land ownership, with considerations of the relationship between landowners and peasants and a discussion of the social contract between the public and the private individuals. And he draws a direct line between the aesthetic improvement of landscape, the well-being of those who live in it, arguing that a taste for nature leads to a greater humanity in human relations. So the larger point here is that the attempt to elaborate a Russian garden rests on the assumption for Bakunin that aesthetic improvements, economic improvements, and moral improvements go hand in hand, and that this approach, which he presents as a quintessentially Russian one, is partly inspired or at least reinforced by reading French landscaping treatises. The establishment of contractual relationships between landowners and serfs, furthermore, is meant to ground the autonomy of the respective parties to the contract, which is conceived as a way to instill a work ethic and hence to make estates economically viable. So enlightenment resides not in the production of philosophical ideas, but in attempts to change institutions and practices on a fairly pragmatic level by way of self-improvement. And finally, this sort of moral transformation, although partly inspired by foreign ideas, is perceived to stake out a genuinely Russian pathway towards improvement. I have a few quotes. There is, in the archive in St. Petersburg, there is a letter of Bakunin to Alenin where he describes what he means by enlightenment. And I thought, just just to kind of, in view of our discussion later on, I'll just quote a few things here to finish my paper. The enlightenment is nothing else than the well-being of the people. Knowledge and the sciences enhance the happiness of the happy, but in distress they are useless, fall into disuse and get lost like needles when there is nothing to sew. Or another one, enlightenment does not come from the sciences, but the sciences prosper from the enlightenment. And then he says, how can we enlighten our people and compare it with other Europeans? Why worry about other Europeans? Is not a gigantic apple tree better than exotic peaches which cannot live without a greenhouse? We have no lack in indigenous goods. And then he finishes that letter with a whole program, I think six points. The first one is a program of enlightenment. The first one is to resurrect Vasilisit, right, and to resurrect justice and to distinguish judgment from slander, Yabeda. The second one is to distinguish morality from bows, right, Nrastvennost at Paklonov. By which I take to mean not to confuse morality with external marks of obedience to a patron or something like that. The third one is to plant the seeds of industriousness and to turn the stinking sources of state and popular prosperity into clear and inexhaustible springs. Number four is to establish clear, mild, and spiritual-based laws in order to distinguish property from appropriation, right from violence. Number five, to resurrect the sciences, arts, commerce, and popular industry. And number six, to define the mutual rights and responsibilities of those in power, the powers of those who are subordinate, and finally, to create man, сотворить человека, or to fashion man. Right, so that's the big kind of ambition of Bakunin. Thank you very much.